using the Ebola vaccine.
A new treatment for preventing migraines.
What happens in people in whom atrial fibrillation is supposedly resolved?
And cannabis and cigarette use among parents.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, posted on May 18th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine here.
Rick, I think we should turn first to the Ebola vaccine. The WHO has just released figures on folks who are infected with Ebola right now in Congo. It turns out that on Saturday, the numbers were 39 people infected, probably. At least 18 of those people have died, and 3 healthcare workers are among those cases, one of whom has died. Based on this, they've decided that they're going to use a vaccine that's been under investigation since the last Ebola outbreak. Now, this is a study that I know you're averse to reporting studies that are older. This is in the Lancet Infectious Diseases, and it was released about a month ago. They used the vesicular stomatitis virus, which is a pretty typical vector. This was, again, a while ago, and they've modified this so that it demonstrates the putative sites so that antibodies are developed. They've used it in several different populations, all of which are kind of small populations, collectively put those together and said, okay, do we still have persistent neutralizing antibodies as a result of the administration of a single dose of this vaccine? And in fact, they conclude that they do still have neutralizing antibodies even after a year. So this is the vaccine now that the WHO is going to roll out in Congo, and I guess that's a good thing.
You're right, Elizabeth. We don't usually report on older studies, but this is unique in that this particular vaccine has been granted breakthrough therapy designation by the FDA and priority medicine status by the European Medicines Agency. It's the sole effective vaccine for Ebola virus. What they showed was that the antibodies are present for a year, but in some of these populations, it actually was present for up to 2 years. And they used high doses and low doses. And in the high dose vaccines, 100% of individuals had antibodies 2 years later. And when they used a lower dose, it was 89%. This particular vaccine's notable because it was a single dose. And that's going to be important in countries like Africa where people may not return to have booster vaccinations.
Of course, this is a really critical problem. When they reported some of the side effects relative to vaccination in this pooled population, they did say that some of these folks developed arthritis. And I guess one concern I have, and I admit that the stakes are really high when you've got Ebola infection and death on one side of the equation, the potential development of arthritis as a result of vaccination seems like a really modest kind of a side effect. I would, however, note that sometimes when we roll these things out in thousands or even tens of thousands of people, we find out that there are some rare but potentially very serious side effects.
So, Elizabeth, the interesting thing was that the people that develop arthritis were more likely to have antibodies for a longer period of time. What that arthritis suggested was it stimulated an immune process that indicated the vaccine was more likely to be effective than in individuals that didn't receive arthritis.
And I guess I would also note that these infectious diseases that seem to occur in places that are far flung are, of course, a threat to everyone worldwide. And so I hope that this actually turns out to be an effective vaccine.
And the reason why they wanted to test it over a year or two is in some individuals, they could detect Ebola virus up to 2 years after the individuals were infected. So you want to make sure that a vaccine is effective during a time where a person could potentially be infectious.
This, of course, is the one I'll discuss on the blog this week. Why don't we turn from here then to one of yours? You picked this one in pediatrics, a look at cannabis use and tobacco use among parents.
Cigarette smoking has decreased across the United States. Now, having said that, there are still about 20 to 25 million households in which parents have kids that cigarette smoke is still in the house. And we're trying to prevent secondhand smoke among children. You can't live in the United States and not be aware that cannabis use has become more prevalent across the United States. So the question is, even though cigarette smoking has declined, what has cannabis use done in homes in which parents have children? So to assess that, the investigators looked at the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. It's an annual nationally representative study conducted in the United States. And what they discovered was that though cigarette smoking has gone down, cannabis use in homes with children has gone up. So now there are about 5 million parents estimated across the United States that smoke cannabis with children in the house. If parents smoke cigarettes, 1 in 5 of them also use cannabis in the home. It was more prevalent for men than for women and lower socioeconomic status, and more prevalent when the parents were 18 to 25 years of age than when they were older. What the authors suggest is that if we're going to talk about secondhand smoke, we need to not just limit it to cigarette use, but we need to talk about cannabis use as well in the home.
This, to me, is emerging as a giant public health experiment. The promulgation of cannabis use across the United States in its many different forms, smoked, vaped, edibles. We really do not know what kind of an impact this is going to have on those whose nervous systems are still developing. Children, of course, even parents in the 18 to 25 age range are still having a lot of neurological development. So I'm concerned about this.
I think we, as a society, should be. We just don't know enough about the long-term effects.
Indeed. Let's turn to the British Medical Journal. We know that atrial fibrillation is a pretty significant risk factor for stroke, increasing someone's risk of stroke by about 5 times if they have that condition. In this study, they took a look at what they called resolved atrial fibrillation, and they had really a pretty large N in all of their different populations here. Over 11,000 people with what they called resolved atrial fibrillation, 15,000 controls with atrial fibrillation, and 22,000 plus who didn't have the condition at all. And they took a look in this resolved group and they said, wow, what's the long-term risk that you're still going to suffer a stroke? And it turns out that, gosh, even in that group, 60% increased risk, even after it's so-called resolved. And of course, there are different ways to resolve atrial fibrillation. I'll let you talk about those.
The reason why it's important to recognize it, as you alluded to, it increases the risk of stroke fivefold. But if we give blood thinners, we can decrease that by about 60 to 70%. But what to do with those people that had an episode of it and now it's gone away, so-called resolved atrial fibrillation, or people that may have had an ablation procedure and it's considered to be cured? We need to rethink whether individuals with resolved atrial fibrillation should be placed or not be placed on anticoagulation. And that's why this particular study is important.
We've talked a little bit before, of course, about these ablation procedures. So let's just turn to that for just one moment. Why are they so unsuccessful? In this study, they cite figures of only 20% where it actually is truly resolved following an ablation procedure.
The ablation procedure is actually very successful if it's done for the right reasons. People that have atrial fibrillation and the heart rate's rapid, if people are getting it to get off blood thinners, though, what this study suggests is it's only 20% successful in keeping someone in normal sinus rhythm all the time.
More to come on this one, no doubt. Let's turn to your last one. In this case, something that we were wondering, have we talked ever in these many years of our recording about migraines? We're not sure we really ever have, but gosh, we're going to talk about that now. It's in the journal, The American Medical Association.
This is a new treatment for migraine. Currently, there are 3 FDA-approved treatments for migraine, propranolol, divalproex, and topiramate. When people have more than 4 episodes per month, these medications are indicated to try to prevent that or reduce it. And we consider it successful if it reduces the migraines by 50% or more. There's a particular protein called calcitonin gene-related peptide that seems to be elevated in individuals with migraine. So these investigators looked at an antibody targeted to this particular protein, and in comparison to placebo, is more effective in preventing migraines. So individuals that had an average of 9 migraines per month, it decreased by 1.5 headaches per month compared to placebo. It was only effective in about 50% of individuals in terms of reducing the number of migraines. That means there are multiple different etiologies, and each of these different medications, by the way, are about effective in 50% of individuals. If we could target which individuals would be most effectively treated by each of these medications, it would be helpful.
It's really very interesting, especially if it's a prophylaxis, if it's something that people can just take all the time and avoid the headache to begin with. But sure sounds to me like we don't fully understand the cascade of reactions that take place to produce a headache.
In fact, it's not probably a single pathway, but multiple pathways. That's why this particular peptide was an important discovery. But I agree with you, Elizabeth. It would be better to have targeted therapies based upon what the particular etiology or cause was in a specific patient.
It just seems that everywhere I turn anyway, I see more and more evidence of the clinical entity really being the tip of the iceberg, in this case, migraine headache, and that in fact the reason that develops could be a multitude of factors that are underneath.
Absolutely. So the final common pathway is the headache. And again, I want to stress that this isn't a treatment for migraines. It's meant to prevent migraines.
Very good. That's a look, then, at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.